This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of cerebral palsy from the pediatric section on orthobullets.com. Cerebral palsy is a non-progressive upper motor neuron disease, otherwise known as static encephalopathy, due to injury to the immature brain. Again, cerebral palsy is a non-progressive upper motor neuron disease, otherwise known as static encephalopathy, due to an injury to the immature brain. Orthopedic manifestations of cerebral palsy include contractures, which we'll talk about in this episode, fractures, which we'll also talk about in this episode, upper extremity deformities, hip subluxation and dislocation, spinal deformity, foot deformities, and gait disorders. As far as the epidemiology of cerebral palsy, by definition, onset must be before 2 years of life, although diagnosis may be delayed in very mild cases. Keep in mind that cerebral palsy is the most common cause of chronic childhood disability. The incidence of cerebral palsy is 2 to 3 per 1,000 people. As far as the pathophysiology of cerebral palsy, this condition leads to muscle imbalance with a mixture of weakness and spasticity. The encephalopathy is static, while the affected portion of the musculoskeletal system changes with growth. Risk factors for cerebral palsy include prematurity, which is the most common, anoxic injuries, prenatal intrauterine factors, perinatal infections, specifically toxoplasmosis, rubella, cytomegalovirus infection, and herpes simplex. You can remember this using the TORCH mnemonic, T-O-R-C-H, where the T stands for toxoplasmosis, the R stands for rubella, C stands for cytomegalovirus infection, and H stands for herpes simplex. Other risk factors for cerebral palsy include meningitis, brain malformations, and brain trauma. Now, let's talk about some associated conditions, specifically orthopedic manifestations characteristic of cerebral palsy. The primary orthopedic manifestations characteristic of cerebral palsy include abnormal tone, loss of motor control, impaired balance, spasticity, hypotonia, and dyskinesias such as chorea and athetosis. Secondary orthopedic manifestations characteristic of cerebral palsy, specifically growth and spasticity related, include contractures, upper extremity deformities, hip subluxation and dislocation, spinal deformity, foot deformities, gait disorders, and fractures. With respect to contractures in the setting of cerebral palsy, this starts as dynamic contractures and they become static with time, with continuous muscle contraction resulting in shortening, and growth, where growth of the bones occurs at a faster longitudinal rate than muscles in spastic cerebral palsy. Fractures are often associated with non-ambulators secondary to low bone mineral density. Bisphosphonates may be useful, and specifically IV pamidronate is considered with greater than or equal to 3 fractures and a DEXA Z-score of less than 2 standard deviations. With respect to the prognosis of cerebral palsy, the most reliable predictor for the ability to walk is independent sitting by age 2. Again, the most reliable predictor for ability to walk in the setting of cerebral palsy is independent sitting by the age of 2. Now, let's talk about the classification of cerebral palsy, and the ones to know include the physiologic classification, the anatomic classification, and the gross motor function classification scale. The physiologic classification is divided into 5 types: spastic, which is the most common, athetoid, ataxic, mixed, and hypotonic. Spastic, again, which is the most common, is characterized as velocity-dependent increased muscle tone and hyperreflexia with slow, restricted movement due to simultaneous contraction of agonist and antagonist muscles. Spastic cerebral palsy is most amenable to operative treatments. The athetoid type of cerebral palsy in the physiologic classification is characterized by constant succession of slow, writhing, involuntary movements. The ataxic type of cerebral palsy in the physiologic classification is characterized by inability to coordinate muscle movements, and this results in an unbalanced, wide-based gait. The mixed type of cerebral palsy in the physiologic classification is usually mixed spastic and athetoid features and involves the entire body. And finally, the hypotonic type of cerebral palsy in the physiologic classification usually precedes spastic or ataxic for 2 to 3 years. Moving on to the anatomic classification, this is divided into 3 types: quadriplegic, diplegic, and hemiplegic. Quadriplegic is total body involvement, and the patients are non-ambulatory. In diplegic, the legs are more affected than the arms, but usually the patients are still ambulatory. The IQ may be normal, as the injury in the brain is midline. And finally, in the hemiplegic type, arms and legs on one side of the body are more affected, usually with spasticity. However, the patients will eventually be able to walk, regardless of treatment. So again, quadriplegic is total body involvement and non-ambulatory. Diplegic, the legs are more commonly involved in the arms, but usually the patients are still ambulatory and the IQ may be normal. And in hemiplegic, arms and legs on one side of the body are usually with spasticity. However, the patients will eventually be able to walk regardless of treatment. Finally, the gross motor function classification scale is divided into 5 levels. Level 1, patients have near normal gross motor function and are independent ambulators. In level 2, patients walk independently but have difficulty with uneven surfaces and have a minimal ability to jump. In level 3, patients walk with assistive devices. In level 4, patients have severely limited walking ability, however, primary mobility is the wheelchair. And finally, level 5, patients are non-ambulators with global involvement and are dependent in all aspects of care. Now let's move on to the evaluation of cerebral palsy. As far as the history, make sure to get a clinical history as well as functional status. Clinical history should include a perinatal history, growth and development, as well as prior medical treatments. Functional status should include sitting slash standing posture, upper and lower extremity function, communication skills, as well as acuity of hearing and vision. Physical exam should involve a general musculoskeletal exam, a gait analysis, spine exam, evaluation of the hips, as well as the foot and ankle. General musculoskeletal exam should specifically test motion, tone, and strength, as well as rotational limb profiles for torsional deformities. Gait should be assessed with a gait lab analysis. You may find plantigrade feet, crouch, and you may find a stiff knee gait. With respect to the spine exam, you should evaluate the presence and flexibility of scoliosis, spinal balance and shoulder height, pelvic obliquity, resting head posture, as well as hamstring contractures, which lead to decreased lumbar lordosis. With respect to evaluation of the hips, you may notice hip contractures, in which flexion contractures lead to excessive lumbar lordosis, and you may also notice an adduction contracture. Hip instability and dislocations are common and may be looked over as a contracture alone. Make sure to observe thigh length in sitting, lengthwise when supine, or the Galeazzi test. Keep in mind that adductor contracture can make examination difficult. Finally, with respect to foot and ankle analysis, equinovarus and planovalgus deformities are common. Make sure to observe wear patterns as well as calluses, note hypertonicity, toe walking or absent heel strike during gait secondary to gastroc soleus spasticity and contracture, and keep in mind that patients may hyperextend the knee to obtain heel contact, and finally, a provocative silver skull test should be done to differentiate gastrocnemius contracture versus Achilles contracture. As far as imaging, standing radiographs should include an AP and a lateral of the hips, as well as a standing spine radiograph as a baseline. As far as an MRI of the brain shows a spectrum of changes, including periventricular leukomalacia white matter lesions, which are most frequent, seen in 56% of patients, while gray matter lesions are seen in 18% of patients, and brain malformations are less frequent in 9% of patients. As far as treatment of spasticity and deformity in the setting of cerebral palsy, this can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes physical therapy, bracing slash orthotics, and medications for spasticity. Spasticity control is typically done with Botox, specifically botulinum A toxin, and or baclofen. Botox or botulinum A toxin is a competitive inhibitor of presynaptic cholinergic receptors with a finite lifetime, and usually lasts 2 to 3 months. This has been a tested point on previous exams, so I'll say it again. Botox or botulinum A toxin is a competitive inhibitor of presynaptic cholinergic receptors with a finite lifetime, and it usually lasts 2 to 3 months. Botox is used to maintain joint motion during rapid growth when a child is too young for surgery, and this is often injected into the gastrocnemius. Keep in mind that this is a helpful treatment in dynamic contractures, however, there's little benefit with static contractures. Baclofen reduces the tone via an unknown mechanism. However, it is thought to act as a GABA agonist. Intrathecal administration is the preferred route to avoid cognitive impairment seen with oral administration, and keep in mind that poor bioavailability leads to difficulty with oral dosing. Again, intrathecal administration of baclofen is the preferred route to avoid cognitive impairment seen with oral administration, and keep in mind that poor bioavailability leads to difficulty with oral dosing. Intrathecal baclofen tends to be used for non-ambulatory cerebral palsy, specifically a gross motor function classification scale of 4 and 5. Moving on to operative options for cerebral palsy, options include soft tissue procedures / releases, selective dorsal rhizotomy, and bony procedures / deformity correction. Soft tissue procedures / releases are indicated to improve function in the child from 3 to 5 years of age with spasticity and voluntary muscle control. Some specific techniques include tenotomies for continuously active muscles, for example, the hip adductor, tendon lengthening for continuously active muscles, for example, Achilles tendon or hamstring, tendon transfers for muscle firing out of phase, for example, the rectus tendon or the tibialis posterior, and keep in mind that tendon transfers in the upper extremity show the best improvement in function in patients with voluntary motor control. This has been a tested point on previous exams, so I'll say it again. Tendon transfers in the upper extremity show the best improvement in function in patients with voluntary motor control. Selective dorsal rhizotomy is indicated in patients age 4 to 8, ambulatory spastic diplegia, and a stable gait pattern that is limited by lower extremity spasticity. Selective dorsal rhizotomy is a neurosurgical resection of dorsal rootlets that do not show a myographic or clinical response to stimulation. Contraindications include athetoid cerebral palsy and non-ambulatory patients with spastic quadriplegia associated with significant spinal deformities. Selective dorsal rhizotomy is falling out of favor due to the limited functional gains and no reduced risk of subsequent musculoskeletal surgeries. Finally, bony procedures / deformity correction is usually performed in later childhood / adolescence. Static contractures, progressive joint breakdown, and certain patterned gait deterioration can be treated with combinations of myotendinous unit lengthening, tendon transfers, and osteotomies. A single-event, multi-level surgery is a concept that arose to limit multiple surgeries, anesthetics, and rehabilitation time for children. This is most successful when combined with a thorough gait lab assessment that predicts improvement in function with multiple-level surgical interventions. Simple lengthenings can cause deterioration in gait when other contractures are, quote, uncovered. Single-event, multi-level surgery management seeks to avoid these iatrogenic complications, and this can be done on bilateral lower extremities in efforts to improve gait. We'll talk about other specific procedures in other episodes about cerebral palsy upper extremity conditions, cerebral palsy spine conditions, cerebral palsy hip conditions, cerebral palsy gait disorders, and cerebral palsy foot disorders. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, which of the following medications works by inhibiting presynaptic acetylcholine vesicle docking and release at peripheral neuromuscular junctions? And the choices are 1, trihexphenidyl, 2, botulinum toxin A, 3, baclofen, 4, gabapentin, and 5, neostigmine. The correct answer to this question is 2, botulinum toxin A. So botulinum toxin A irreversibly binds at the neuromuscular junction to prevent presynaptic release of acetylcholine, thereby preventing muscular contraction. To quickly review, botulinum toxin A is commonly used for the treatment of dynamic spasticity in patients with cerebral palsy. The generally accepted mechanism of botulinum toxin is inhibition of acetylcholine release at the neuromuscular junction after uptake into cholinergic neurons. Once inside the cell, one of the serotypes cleaves snare proteins, which are required for vesicle docking and release, thereby inhibiting neurotransmitter release. Each serotype, A, B, and C, acts at a different site and has a slightly different effect and duration. Intramuscular injections of botulinum toxin A can result in 3 to 4 months of muscle relaxation. It's important to note that it is only effective on the dynamic spasticity of cerebral palsy and is ineffective on static contractures. Molinares et al. Evaluated the efficacy of botulinum toxin A in patients with cerebral palsy. They found injections lead to greater functional improvements in patients with mild cerebral palsy and when multi-level injections were given. They also found that outcomes were more successful with physical therapy, post-injection casting, and frequency of orthotic use. the authors concluded that multi-level and repeat injection of botulinum toxin A can provide functional improvements. Aoki et al. Reviewed the pharmacology and immunological effects of botulinum neurotoxins. They state that in addition to reducing muscle contractility, botulinum neurotoxins can have indirect effects on sensory afferents and anti-nociceptive effects. Additionally, diffusion from the site of injection can cause unwanted paralysis. For example, sternocleidomastoid injection diffusing towards the esophagus, causing dysphagia. And immunologic responses can lead to sensitization. They emphasize an awareness of the difference in preparation of botulinum toxins that can have different pharmacologic profiles. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, trihexafentanil is incorrect, as this is a synthetic anticholinergic drug which functions as a competitive antagonist at muscarinic receptors to decrease acetylcholine. Answer 3, baclofen is incorrect, as this is an analog of gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA, that binds to GABA receptors in the spinal cord, decreasing the release of excitatory neurotransmitters. Answer 4, gabapentin is incorrect, as gabapentin can decrease pain transduction by reducing hyperexcitability of voltage-gated calcium channels in neurons. And answer 5, neostigmine is incorrect, as neostigmine is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, which would cause increased levels of acetylcholine and therefore stimulation of nicotinic and muscarinic receptors. Moving on to the next question. All the following statements about preoperative evaluation of patients with scoliosis and cerebral palsy are true except. And the choices are 1, patients should be weighed or otherwise evaluated for nutritional status. 2, pulmonary status should be assessed either with formal pulmonary function testing, sleep study, or history, clinical exam, and radiography, and a separate chest radiograph may not be needed if there is a full scoliosis film. 3, preoperative MRI of the spinal axis is routinely performed. 4, some anti-seizure medications may interfere with coagulation. And 5, evaluation of swallowing ability and gastroesophageal reflux status should be considered preoperatively to assess the risk for aspiration pneumonia. However, if the history indicates that this is clearly not a problem, formal evaluation is not needed. The correct answer to this question is 3, preoperative MRI of the spinal axis is routinely performed. So MRI of the spine is not routinely performed preoperatively in patients with cerebral palsy and scoliosis. Pulmonary, nutrition, gastrointestinal, and neurologic evaluations are key components of a multidisciplinary approach to the preoperative evaluation of cerebral palsy patients undergoing scoliosis surgery. The true incidence of intraspinal lesions in cerebral palsy patients is unknown, but believed to be uncommon. MRI may still be indicated based on other factors, such as change in neurologic exam or rapid curve progression, but it is not routinely performed. McCarthy et al. Reviewed the etiology, natural history, assessment, and treatment of patients with scoliosis and cerebral palsy. They stress the importance of a multidisciplinary approach to these patients as they are at a higher risk of complications. They include aspiration pneumonia, gastrointestinal dysmotility, implant failure, neurologic complications, which are uncommon, and wound infection. It's noted that as patients whose weight is less than the 5th percentile may be at increased risk for such complications. Moving on to the next question. A non-communicative 16-year-old girl with spastic quadriplegic cerebral palsy and a 75-degree thoracolumbar scoliosis undergoes a successful posterior spinal fusion with instrumentation. What is the most predictable outcome of the surgical procedure? And the choices are 1, improved cognitive function, 2, improved caregiver satisfaction, 3, improved nutrition, 4, decreased pain, and 5, improved mobility. The correct answer to this question is 2, improved caregiver satisfaction. So surgical treatment of spinal deformity in a totally involved child with cerebral palsy has been shown on outcome instruments to significantly improve the caregiver's perception of the child's comfort. The other parameters mentioned are difficult to measure and unpredictable. Moving on to the next question. In patients with cerebral palsy, voluntary control of motion best predicts improvement in function after which of the following? And the choices are 1, Botox injection, 2, selective dorsal rhizotomy, 3, wrist/hand tendon transfer surgery, 4, femoral derotational osteotomies, and 5, tibial derotational osteotomies. The correct answer to this question is 3, wrist/hand tendon transfer surgery. So tendon transfer surgery is used to maximize function in patients with cerebral palsy. Van Heest et al. In 1999 evaluated 134 patients where 718 procedures were performed in the upper extremities. Treatment was tailored to each child's needs and included soft tissue releases of deforming spastic muscles, tendon transfers to augment antagonistic activity, and joint stabilization. Using a 9-level functional use score, the authors showed an average improvement of 2.6 functional levels for all patients. Patients with good voluntary control had the greatest improvement in functional use scores. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following decreases acetylcholine levels in the synaptic cleft by blocking the presynaptic release of acetylcholine peripherally? And the choices are 1. Lidocaine, 2. Botulinum toxin A, 3. Acetylcholinesterase, 4. Baclofen, and 5. Pyridostigmine. The correct answer to this question is 2. Botulinum toxin A. So decreased acetylcholine levels in the presynaptic cleft weaken the strength of muscle contraction through paralysis of the portion of the muscle whose neuromuscular junctions are blocked. Botox exhibits this peripheral mechanism of action in the treatment of spastic muscle disorders like cerebral palsy. While botulinum toxin A, acetylcholinesterase, and baclofen all demonstrate a decrease in spasticity, only botulinum toxin A does so by blocking the presynaptic release of acetylcholine peripherally. Baclofen acts as a gamma-aminobutyric acid or GABA agonist. Baclofen exerts its effects more centrally as an agonist at presynaptic GABA-B away from the neuromuscular junction. This occurs primarily at the spinal cord level to inhibit the transmission of both monosynaptic and polysynaptic reflexes. Postsynaptic effects of baclofen have been demonstrated only at concentrations above the therapeutic range. Acetylcholinesterase is an enzyme that degrades acetylcholine. Pyridostigmine blocks the function of acetylcholinesterase, thus increasing acetylcholine levels. Finally, lidocaine blocks the voltage-gated sodium channels, unrelated to acetylcholine metabolism. Das and Park treated 6 patients with spasticity due to stroke-related hemiplegia with botulinum toxin type A injection into skeletal muscle. The patients showed subjective and objective improvement without any significant side effects. Moving on to the next question. A 6-year-old male child has cerebral palsy and limited ambulatory function. Physical exam is notable for mild spasticity in all 4 extremities, with the lower extremities demonstrating more involvement than the upper extremities. Cognitive function is mildly delayed for chronologic age. Pelvis radiograph is notable for dysplasia of bilateral hips. Which of the following terms best describes this patient's cerebral palsy? And the choices are 1. Hemiplegia, 2. Diplegia, 3. Paraplegia, 4. Monoplegia, and 5. Total body. The correct answer to this question is 2. Diplegia. So cerebral palsy is defined as static encephalopathy with onset prior to 2 years of age due to variably severe upper motor neuron dysfunction. Most often the cause is not identifiable, but perinatal infections like the TORCH viruses, prematurity, which is the most common, anoxic injuries, head injuries, and meningitis are thought to be the cause. The hips, spine, knees, and hands are commonly involved. Coleman et al. Review the musculoskeletal issues associated with cerebral palsy, including etiology and management options. Family-directed use of holistic approaches are widespread and discussed, but traditional medical techniques remain the mainstay of treatment strategies at this time. Cerebral palsy is classified by physiology or anatomy. With respect to the physiology classification, spastic is defined as increased muscle tone and hyperreflexia with slow restricted movements secondary to simultaneous contracture of agonists and antagonists. This is the most common form. CP spasticity is characterized by increased muscle tone, hyperreflexia, and tone that increases with velocity. Athetosis is constant succession of slow writhing involuntary motions. Ataxia is inability to coordinate muscles for voluntary movement and is characterized by a wide base gait. And mixed is a combination of spastic and athetosis with total body involvement. The anatomy classification consists of hemiplegia, diplegia, paraplegia, quadriplegia, and monoplegia. Hemiplegia affects both limbs on one side, and the arm is usually worse than the leg. In diplegia, it affects the right and left side equally, and minimal spasticity may be present in the upper limbs, but lower limb spasticity predominates. IQ may be near normal. Paraplegia affects both legs, and there is sparing of the arms. Quadriplegia affects both legs and both arms and is associated with low IQ and higher mortality. And finally, monoplegia affects only one limb. Moving on to the next question. An 18-year-old girl with quadriplegic cerebral palsy underwent posterior spinal fusion from T2 to the pelvis 3 weeks ago. She now has a low-grade fever and mild midline erythema in a 1-centimeter area from which there is slight clear yellowish drainage. What is the next most appropriate step in management? And the choices are 1. Oral antibiotics empirically, 2. Culture of the drainage and oral antibiotics, 3. Aspiration of the wound and IV antibiotics empirically, 4. Wound culture with incision and debridement, IV antibiotics and retention of instrumentation, and 5. Wound culture with incision and debridement, IV antibiotics and removal of instrumentation followed by bracing. The correct answer to this question is 4. Wound culture with incision and debridement, IV antibiotics and retention of instrumentation. So the presence of drainage 3 weeks after surgery is a sign of wound infection. This infection most likely involves deep tissues until proven otherwise. Oral or IV antibiotics in the absence of debridement are not sufficient. Removal of the hardware would lead to rapid progression of the scoliosis in a spine that has been surgically destabilized by removal of the facet joints. The appropriate treatment is debridement with wound culture, IV antibiotics, and retention of hardware. The wound should be closed over drains. And moving on to the final question, which of the following findings is most prognostic for the ability of a young child with cerebral palsy to walk? And the choices are 1. Ability to sit independently by age 2 years, 2. Ability to creep by age 2 years, 3. Ability to roll by age 2 years, 4. Pattern of cerebral palsy like quadriplegia, diplegia, or hemiplegia, and 5. Type of motor dysfunction like spastic, ataxic, dyskinetic, or hypotonic. The correct answer to this question is 1. Ability to sit independently by age 2 years. So several studies have shown that sitting ability by age 2 years is highly prognostic of walking. Molnar and Gordon reported that children not sitting independently by age 2 years had a poor prognosis for walking. Wu and associates reported that children sitting without support by age 2 years had an odds ratio of 26-1 of walking compared to those unable to sit. This was far higher than the odds ratios for cerebral palsy location, motor dysfunction, crawling, creeping, scooting, or rolling. That's all for this review about cerebral palsy. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.